This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Joining us from Maine Public Broadcasting is Sarah Smiley. She lives in Bangor and is a syndicated columnist and author of several books about her life as a military wife. She's married to a Navy pilot, and they have three sons. She began writing a column called Shore Duty more than a decade ago as a way to offer support to women like her, wives who hold the family together when their husbands are deployed overseas. Her latest book is Dinner with the Smileys. Sarah, welcome to Where We Live.
Hi, thank you.
So first, tell us about your family.
Well, my husband, he's a Navy pilot, and we have three boys and a dog named Sparky.
And I'd also read that you're a Navy brat. So for the civilians out there, tell us what that means.
I grew up in the military family as well, and my dad was also a Navy pilot. And in fact, I met my husband because our dads flew together in a squadron in San Diego in the 1970s. And our dads were on deployment when I was born. My husband's a year older than me. But so that means that I met my husband before I met my dad, because I didn't meet my dad till I was 7 months old, until he came back from deployment. But I met Dustin, who lived around the corner right after I was born.
That's quite a love story. And so you knew what it was like to be part of a military family, a father that was away for some months out of a year throughout his military career, and you ended up also being a Navy wife.
Yes. Isn't that ironic? And I always said that I would never marry somebody in the military because I resented how much my dad had been away. And I said that I just didn't, I was tired of that lifestyle and I didn't want to marry anybody in the military. And pretty much the next day, I met Dustin again after 10 years of being apart, and I was married, I think, about 9 months later, and there I was, a military wife again.
And I had mentioned in the intro that you've been writing for some time about your life as a military family. This new book of yours, Dinner with the Smileys, focuses in on a time when your husband, Dustin, got orders that he was being deployed to Djibouti, Africa for about 13 months. Is that right?
Yes.
So how did your family prepare for this?
Well, the other times that my husband deployed and where I started writing was in Florida, and my husband did two deployments from there, and we were in largely military communities where there's a lot of deployments and a lot of military families. So when you tell someone my husband's deployed, pretty much everybody knows what that truly means for you and your kids. This was going to be the first time that my husband deployed from an area that is not a large military active duty military area like Bangor. Mm-hmm. And I was concerned that would my neighbors really know what it meant when I said that my husband was leaving for 13 months? Would we be forgotten? Those mm-hmm. kind of things were going through my mind. And I knew from the previous two deployments as well that dinner time is the hardest time when they're gone, because during the day you're taking the kids to school, you're at work, you're doing errands, you're meeting friends for lunch, and then dinner time comes and all of those other people go home with their families, and you're left there alone with an empty seat at the dinner table. So knowing this going into the deployment and feeling kind of anxious about those feelings again of being alone in the evening at dinner right before my husband left, because dinner time's always been really important to us, that we all sit down together at the table. One of our boys said, "It'll be really strange not to have Dad in his seat." And I just sort of reflexively said, "Well, we'll fill his seat. We'll invite friends over and neighbors." And it snowballed from there. It was one of those things that I didn't set out to write a book about it. I set out to just fill up our time while my husband was gone instead of putting our lives on hold for 13 months. But it really caught on, and I started to learn some bigger messages that I wanted to share with people.
Early on in your book, you say that, you know, you don't like to cook, you hate small talk. So when I'm reading this book, it doesn't sound like an easy thing to commit to, that you're going to open your home to strangers for a year and invite them to have dinner with you and your family.
It wasn't. And it was really outside of my nature. You know, some people are just born hostesses and they love to do that. And they have all of the linens and the tableware and everything that you should have if you're going to entertain people. I don't have any of those things. In fact, when Senator Collins from Maine came to dinner, I gave her a paper towel to put in her lap as a napkin because I don't own linens. And so entertaining is not my strong point, but I knew that I had to step out of my box and reach out to people and bring them to our table if I was going to get through these 13 months without feeling isolated. And at the end, I started to feel like it was easier. And one of the things that I hope people will get from the book is that people of my generation, I think, raising a young family right now, we feel like, oh, I would love to have that person over to dinner, but I'd have to clean the house and I'd have to figure out something to cook. And I really don't cook that well. You know, all these things go through our minds, so we don't do it. Well, I hope that when people read the book, they'll see that I never cleaned my house, not even for Senator Collins. I was cooking lasagna for pretty much every single meal, lasagna, spaghetti, or pizza. The boys said that it was a year of red sauce. So it was nothing fancy. But by being genuine and letting people into our lives, and that authenticity, I felt, brought people closer to us rather than pushing them away, as I think holds a lot of people back from inviting someone in, because they think, well, what will they think if my kids misbehave or if my house is dirty? But I found the opposite, that by being real, it brought people closer, and then they helped us through that year.
So before your husband deployed, he knew about this idea and he was pretty supportive of it.
Yes, he, in fact, you know, in the beginning when I said, well, we'll fill his seat, I meant the kids' friends, my friends, neighbors. But my husband was the one that really started pushing it, because he knew how much I had struggled through the first two deployments and how I had sometimes felt kind of isolated. And, you know, because when you have young kids and your husband's gone, you could go days without seeing another adult and having adult conversation. And so he was really pushing the idea not to do what I ended up doing, where inviting one person a week, but he was just telling me, reach out, you know, call people, invite people to dinner. Don't isolate yourself. Reach out to people when you need help. That was his main point for me.
And you have three sons. So this was the first deployment where all of them were at an age where they're really going to notice that dad wasn't going to be there.
Yes. And one of the hardest things for me and for them was filling the role of both mother and father, because I like to use the example of their Little League games. My boys are really into baseball. And when my husband and I are both there and we go to Little League games, my husband is the one who's the realist with them. If they get an out, my husband will say, you know, if they get called out, my husband will say, well, you know, you're holding the bat too high, or you're swinging late, or whatever. He tells them the facts. And I'm the one who comes up behind and says, you look really great out there. You look so great and you're doing so great. You know, I'm the cheerleader. And so it was hard for me when he was gone that I had to do both of those roles. I had to kind of coach the boys, give them the real deal, and be cheerleader. And that was a struggle for me. And I think it was a struggle for the boys, too. They really missed some of those things that their dad provides for them that I could not. And so by bringing these people into our lives 1 week at a time, one dinner at a time, I found that what ended up happening was that I was providing father figures for the boys and role models. And a lot of these people went out of their way even after the dinner to take the boys out to play catch or to come to their baseball games. And they were kind of helping to bridge that gap between what I could give them and what they were missing from their dad.
So you really began to rely on the community, even though you weren't on a military base, like you said before, where there's that support and people know what you're going through. A lot of them were civilians and maybe were not aware of some of the challenges of a family like yours when your loved one is deployed for so long.
That's right. Most of them were civilians. I can only think of a few that were military families. And, you know, I think civilians, they know about service members serving overseas and their families staying behind in sort of a abstract kind of way, I think. They see people saying goodbye to their loved ones on the evening news when a ship deploys, and they see the happy homecomings when they come back home, little snippets here and there on the news. But I think what I was showing people is what happens on every day in between those, between the departure and the homecoming, what it really means to be a military family who's left behind. And our guests, sometimes when they came into the house, they would be a little bit overwhelmed and they would say, you know, I don't think I should sit in your husband's seat. I'll sit on the other end of the table. And of course, my youngest son would say, but the rule is you have to sit in my dad's seat. You have to sit there. And so they would sit. And then later, they would often write to me and say how much it had impacted them, that they realized for the first time what it meant to have my husband gone when they were sitting there in his chair, looking at his family, hearing his family talk about their day, and realizing that my husband, who was halfway across the world would have given anything to be in that seat where they were. And so I think it made it, took it from an abstract idea of that, yes, military families serve and sacrifice, to a very real one of what that truly looks like and means.
Today we're talking with Sarah Smiley, the author of Dinner with the Smileys. She's a Navy wife with three sons, and her new book describes how the family started inviting a guest to dinner each week as a way to cope with her husband's 13-month deployment. So let's talk about the guest that you had come to your house. You mentioned the first one was U.S. Senator Susan Collins.
Yes. My son was learning about local government and local elected officials, and he decided he would write a letter to Senator Collins. I never thought she would have time to come, but I said, you know, this is a great experience learning how to write a letter. And so we sent it, and then sure enough, about 2 weeks later, her office called and said she would be honored to come sit in his seat. And I was banging my head on the wall going, oh my gosh, what have I done? I don't cook. But, you know, some of our guests that get a lot of attention are the senators, the governors that we had, the Red Sox, and the professional Major League Baseball player used to play for the Padres. We had a lot of high-profile people come to dinner, and they get a lot of attention when I'm out talking about Dinner with the Smileys. But what I've always tried to tell people who want to do the same thing, because a lot of people have said, oh, I wish I could do that, or that would be something my family could do during a deployment, but I don't know how I would go about inviting a U.S. senator to my house. And I tell them the most life-changing, character-building, memorable dinners were the dinners with people whose names you won't know until you read the book. They weren't senators. They weren't governors. While those people were special, too, in fact, Congressman Michoud from Maine, he still sends my boys a handwritten letter every Christmas, and he remembers what age they are now and what grade they're in. So those people were special too. But the just regular individuals, the school teachers who came, the local artist, the local band that plays, these are the people that have really, those are the dinners that the boys talk about a lot. You know, they thought meeting the Red Sox was really cool. And they'll tell you that right off the bat if you say, who's the coolest person that you met? But when it comes down to, on a daily basis, who are the guests that they talk about? It's the school teachers, the policemen, the firemen, the people in their lives that anybody could invite to dinner.
Besides going through the process in your book of, you know, who would you invite next and how your boys were reacting to them, you were also really open about just the struggles that you had parenting your three boys while your husband was away. And, you know, making a point in the book to say, you know, this is in short term, even though 13 months is a long time, I'm not a single mom, you know, year round. And you really pay homage to those parents out there that are doing this every day. That's the reality.
Oh, my gosh. I know. I had them on my mind a lot because I had a light at the end of the tunnel. I knew that my husband was coming home on this day. But it's exhausting when you don't have someone there, when you don't, to use baseball terms, because we do that a lot in our family, if you don't have a relief pitcher to say, I'm tired, I'm run down, or I have a lot of work I've got to finish up, could you take the kids to go get dinner? Could you put the kids to bed? When you don't have that person to lean on at the end of the day, it's exhausting. I would go to bed just completely wiped out. And then, of course, you wake up in the morning and you do it all over again. And it's tiring, and I'm not sure that a lot of people really appreciate that and understand what single parents go through.
And how did you see your boys change? So you have Ford, the eldest, and, you know, he seemed to be the one that gave you the most trouble because he's going in through adolescence at the time. But how did they change in that year with these guests coming to your home?
Well, I'm ashamed to say that my boys are really rowdy, and maybe that's the dynamic of having three boys. And I never sat down and really explained table manners to them. All of this was by the seat of my pants. And like I said, I never thought I was going to write a book about it. It was just something we were doing. And so I never sat down and said, you put the napkin in your lap, or, you know, this is how you talk to a guest. It just didn't. But they learned it week by week by, you know, in the beginning, for the first, you know, three quarters of the year, someone ended up in timeout at every dinner, or somebody ended up in tears. And when the minister came to dinner, they truly were wrestling on the kitchen floor until he told them to stop. So, I mean, this was not pretty. This was not like, you know, the Cleavers at dinner. And it was life as it would be if my husband was there at dinner. But what I watched happen was that by bringing these people to the table, by giving my boys real world experience of sitting with an adult that they don't know and making conversation and being polite and passing food, that they just learned it. I never had to have like a sit down and discuss it with them. They just figured it out. And Ford, who was so ornery and battling me in the beginning because he was so resentful that his dad was gone, the book is really a lot his story about how he grew and changed. And by the end of the year, I saw him shaking hands with our guests when they came in the door and thanking them for coming when they were leaving and telling his brothers to quiet down when someone was talking. And that was not something that I ever sat down and talked to him about. He just figured it out. He learned it. And I wonder sometimes, again, with my generation today, that a lot of times when we have a dinner party or we're going to have a couple over to dinner, we either have a kids' table where the kids are separated, or we send the kids off with a babysitter or a neighbor's house, or we send them upstairs to bed because we don't want to be embarrassed by them or by their behavior. But I think by doing that, we've missed the opportunity to give our children those experiences of being at a table with grown-ups and making conversation.
I'd like to shift to how this has impacted you through the years and how the process of bringing people into your home has helped you as a military wife. You've said it's not easy when your husband has been away and you're left to parent them while also working.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, you know, the year was such a pivotal year for all of us, I think. And just as much as the boys grew and changed through that year, I think I did as well. But I think the biggest lesson for me was that this idea of loneliness at the dinner table is not military families alone. As I said, I started out as thinking I want to teach the community about what it means to be a military family. But very quickly that changed to me realizing there are a lot of people in our communities who are alone at dinner time, whether they're empty nesters or divorced or widowed. And some of that revelation happened when we had dinners at assisted living facilities with elderly guests and in particular with an Alzheimer's patient. And I think that really moved me. That was when I decided I wanted to write the book, because I became so aware of how many people each night go home to an empty seat at the dinner table. And that's kind of come with me, even though my husband's home now. We do a lot of going back to nursing homes to eat with people or inviting our neighbors over at the spur of the moment. Just letting people in to your lives. I think everybody ends up the better.
Your husband is still in the military. I know he's in leadership roles. And I was curious how, when you started writing this column as a young military wife and how it's evolved through the years, you know, have you ever felt like it would impact his career at all? Because you're talking about something that, you know, a lot of people don't know. They don't know the life of a military family unless you are in that family. And so you're really kind of, you know, talking about things that maybe not everyone is comfortable talking about, or, you know, the idea that you want to be supportive of your loved one. They have a job to do. But at the same time, you don't always have to agree with what's going on in Washington and the decisions that are being made there that impact you and so many other families.
Yes, when I first started out, I guess about 13 years ago now, there weren't very many people writing about being a military wife. In fact, that's why my column kind of took hold and got picked up by other newspapers, because it was sort of new ground. And I got a lot of criticism from the military community saying, you know, you shouldn't be writing about these things, or how will this affect your husband's career? And thank goodness, my husband has never censored me. He's always said, you know, I'm in the military, you're not. And you can have your own opinions as long as you don't put words in my mouth, is what he says. You know, if you're going to quote me, make sure it's right. He says you can write whatever you want to. And he's always been very supportive of that. You know, that's why people go into the military, is to defend that right to be able to say and have an opinion of your own. He does kid sometimes that, you know, what will people think when he goes into work in the morning after a certain column comes out? And sometimes my dad, who retired as an admiral, says that he's glad I have a different last name now. But you know, both of them realize that I'm not in the military. I'm a civilian, so I'm not held to the same standards that they are.
Mm-hmm. since you started your column, you mentioned at first maybe there was some criticism in the military community, but you write this column weekly. You have at least three books now that talk about your life as a Smiley. What are you hearing now from military families? There's so much emphasis now on supporting the veteran. Are military families getting that same kind of support?
I think they are, although this past Memorial Day or Veterans Day, I wrote a column about because one of my good friends who had been a big cheerleader for me during Dinner with the Smileys lost her husband to a helicopter accident 2 weeks before he was supposed to come home for homecoming. And so here she had been cheering me along all through Dinner with the Smileys, always commenting on the post on Facebook and everything. And now she has a permanent empty seat at the table 2 weeks before she thought he was coming home. And so that was weighing really heavy on my mind when Veterans Day came around this year and or last year. And I wrote a column about how while it's wonderful that we recognize veterans and we should, that we also need to recognize the veteran wives like my friend who has given up everything. Her entire life has just changed because her husband served in the military. And I was surprised that I got so much backlash from that, of people saying that I had disrespected veterans and that spouses have no place on Veterans Day. And it really took me back. And it wasn't just criticism from civilians. It was criticism from people in the military community, too. So I think things have gotten better, but I think we have a ways to go that, that we do need to look at people like my friend who have given up so much in support of the military. And I think it's okay to think of her on Veterans Day.
Mm-hmm. Your husband made it home safely from his 13-month deployment. What is life like now for you? Are there any more Dinner with the Smileys?
Well, the boys really learned through that year to love dinner. And not because it's the time that you sit down and you eat at the end of the day, but they've just realized that it's an experience. It's an opportunity to talk face to face with your parents, which is, such a novel thing in this world where everybody's on their phones and their computers and everything. And it's an opportunity to learn about new people and meet people in the community. So it's really become part of the culture of our family now that if we sit down just the five of us to dinner, we feel kind of empty. And I'll send one of the boys out and I'll say, hey, go ask our neighbor who's young and works nights as a nurse. I'll say, go ask her if she wants to come over and eat some. We've got extra. Or I'll say, go invite the lady across the street who's elderly lady whose husband died during the book. And it just feels right to have people at our table. And the boys have encouraged that. They'll say, if we've gone a couple of weeks of just our family eating, they'll say, when are we going to invite someone to dinner? And we don't do it as an event anymore like we were during the book where we were taking pictures and I was writing about it and all of those things. But it's just something we do now. It's kind of part of our routine.
And how did you see the Bangor community change from the Dinner with the Smileys? Did you see a lot more people being neighborly, or is that just a sense of Bangor on a normal day?
Well, that is one of the characteristics of Bangor. But what surprises me is that on Facebook, I'll see one of our dinner guests commenting on another dinner guest's photo that I didn't know they knew each other. And so I will send a message to them and say, how do you guys know each other? And they say, oh, from Dinner with the Smileys. And so in some ways, not only did we build a community around us, but that community started to become a community, too. And people met each other through the dinners and through that shared experience of having been a part of it.
Well, I've been speaking with Sarah Smiley. She's been writing about her life as a military spouse for a number of years. She has a new book out, Dinner with the Smileys. She lives in Maine, and I hear you'll be coming to Connecticut soon for a book signing.
Yes, and I'm so excited because this is not an ordinary book signing. It's going to be a dinner. So, a lot of times book signings, you stand in line, the author signs your book, and then off you go, which always just feels kind of cheap to me. I love this because people who come to this book signing, we're going to be hanging out. We're going to be having dinner. We're going to be talking. And I'll be signing books, of course. But it's really a chance to get to know one another and to talk rather than just the usual stand in line, sign a book, and leave.
Will you be making the famous Smiley lasagna?
I don't think that I'll have the opportunity because I'll be traveling. But But people can find the recipe online.
So Sarah Smiley will be at R.J. Julia Booksellers in Madison September 18th. And we'll have information on our website. I think they're asking for people also to RSVP. And the local nonprofit, the Community Dining Room, will be accepting food donations. Sarah Smiley, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
When we come back from our break, we'll hear voices from military families at Naval Submarine Base New London as they await the arrival of their loved ones who were deployed. And later, the story of a new military spouse who got married just before her husband's deployment. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel in for John Dankosky. You can join the conversation on our website, WMPR.org, or you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel, in for John Dankosky. Today we're talking about the lives of military families. They're the ones who often provide the biggest support to service members and veterans, but who supports them? Recently, we traveled down to the only active-duty military installation in the state. It's Naval Submarine Base, New London. On this day, the families of sailors aboard the USS Annapolis had gathered on the base to welcome the submarine home. There are support groups that are assigned to military families. They're called Family Readiness Groups, or FRGs. I spoke to Lisa Lambert. She leads the group assigned to the families of sailors who served aboard the USS Annapolis. So the sailors that are coming back, do they all live on base, or are they from all over?
Pretty much all over. Some are what they call geobatching, where they're here and their wives live somewhere else in the United States. I live in Groton, actually less than 5 minutes from the base. Some people live in housing. Others live in areas that they commute to the sub base anywhere from half an hour to 45 minutes.
How does the Family Readiness Group give support to these families while their sailors are deployed?
We do a monthly activities. One is for the children, all age groups, and we vary from outside, inside, all age groups. We do an adult evening, whether we went to the movies, we went bowling, we went and did one of those painting things, and we try to do as many activities as we can in addition to where we have a monthly meeting. We usually have guest speakers come from Fleet and Family Support to talk about the stages of deployment. We did it at the beginning of deployment for those that haven't done it before to know the emotions that they're going to go through is normal. Then we did it midway, because at that point we were halfway, and we're in a routine. And then we did homecoming last month to get them ready for homecoming.
Tell me, what are the challenges that military families go through when their loved ones are deployed?
You know, when they first leave, you're sad. You think, how am I going to do this? I have four children, so it's trying to the balance of being strong for my children, but also letting them know it's okay to miss daddy. I miss daddy. Then you get into a routine, and then there's the transition of, oh, he's coming home. How's he going to fit into this routine? This is our sixth deployment, so for us, we've figured out how to do it. So the last few port calls and emails have been me updating him on, you know, this is the time the kids go to bed now. These are the new routines that were not there in March, so that when he comes home, he doesn't feel out of the loop, or he's the heavy, because now he's like, well, that's not how we did it 6 months ago. The group that we have created through the FRG is very close-knit, so there's the withdrawal that we're kind of going through, because us girls won't all be together again, even though we're ecstatic that our husbands are home. There's the challenges of raising kids on your own. You know, there's no one to bounce ideas off of, or those adult conversations in the evenings when the kids go to bed. So,
and then missed maybe birthdays, holidays.
Yep. This year we turned 40. So he was home for our 40th, and then they deployed 3 days later. July 4th, he wasn't here. He missed two of my son's birthdays. We missed our anniversary. But we kind of, when he comes home, we celebrate all those things that we've missed, because it's really just a day. So we'll do a birthday party. We'd get the cake. We do the cupcakes. So we kind of do it just after the fact. and you just make adjustments.
Tell me about the ceremony when the sailors come.
I've been in and out of tears all day. A group of the wives are going to head down to the beach, so they'll let us know when they see it. And then we just start looking, and then the boat will have a big lei on it that we made, red, white, and blue, and it'll come down the river, and then we watch it get ported, and the tugs pull in. The sub school is going to be coming down and doing their little ceremony where they all chant and cheer. And after they're all hooked up, First Kiss Goes, which is a fundraiser that the FRG does, that one wife's name gets picked and her husband gets to be the first one off the boat. And then we do first babies. We had two babies that were born and the dads were not here. And then you just wait. And the command will let us go down the pier. And everyone moves down the pier, and then you just wait until you see your sailor come up through the boat.
Your husband's on this boat?
Yes. Yep. This is our sixth deployment. He's been in the Navy for 18 and a half years. Email is sporadic. It's not the traditional email that everyone is used to, which is a challenge or a transition for some of our first-timers, because in the regular world, email is pretty immediate. What happens with us, because they're on submarines, it goes to what they call an email box. And then when the boat gets to a certain place, they upload. Sometimes the emails don't make it. So we have had email. They've had four port calls, so we've gotten to speak to them via phone. But besides that, when they're under, our only communication is email.
So your sixth deployment. Tell me, what is the transition like for you and your family?
We go into it with no expectations. In the beginning of our deployments, I had visions of we're going to do this, we're going to do that, I'm going to make this for dinner. And then when things don't go the way I had visioned, so now we just have no expectations. We have no plans. It's just to reconnect. I'm fortunate that I'm going to have my parents, my mother-in-law, and my brother and sister-in-law with us. We'll all be at the pier, and then they'll go home. It'll just be us as a family of six reconnecting, reuniting. My three children are actually going to be on their way shortly with my family, and my son's going to be coming with his school band because they'll be playing for homecoming.
So when all the sailors are home and, there's a routine, you know, they still missed out on, you know, the life that was happening here, while they were gone. So what kind of support do you give families? Because you know what it's like when your loved one's back, but it's still not quite the way it was.
Right. What we recommend is write a journal. And then share your journal, because then they can feel like they were part of it after the fact. If you kept a journal and you wrote it, the emotions that you were feeling at that moment are there. For instance, my son played baseball, and when he stole home and won the game, I wrote it in my journal. And so the emotions were in the writing, so he'll get to read it, and then it will then give him an avenue on what to talk to the kids about. Verse being like, so what have you been up to for 6 months? We've done a lot of photos, so we can look at the photos and talk about, you know, what we were doing. And we also have planned a couple of trips all together for when he's home, so that immediately we're creating memories as soon as he gets home.
And that's important.
Right. You know, there is going to be the transition where after about 2 weeks, he's going to say, it must be hard for him to come back and figure out where he fits. So we have very good open communication, so that helps. And the command is really good about supporting the guys. My husband's a chief, so he's been talking to his guys over the last month about, okay, when you get home, you know, things have changed, you've changed, she's changed. Doesn't mean it's bad. Everyone associates change with challenges and things that are not good, but if you have an open communication and you can realize how you've changed and you share it, it makes the transition easier.
That was Lisa Lambert, who led a support group for the families of sailors aboard the USS Annapolis. The submarine came home on September 11th after a six-month deployment. Plenty of families gathered near the pier that day with their welcome home signs. Many came from the Groton area. Others were from out of state, including Pennsylvania and New Hampshire. Here are some of the family members' stories.
My name is Nicole Welling, and I live here in Groton, Connecticut. My husband is coming back. We've been together Almost 10 years. Like, we'll be married in January for 9, but together 10. It was nice having a lot of support, lots of family and friends supporting me along the way, so that helped a lot. I kept very busy, did lots of activities with my kids. I have a 2-year-old, and, well, now they're 3 and 7. They've had birthdays throughout this. It was hard to explain. I don't think they understand time, really. But I just made a point, like, we just kind of went month by month, and we had fun activities planned each month, and I just kept them focused on the fun things we were doing. And, you know, we were able to email so they could be a part of that, and they wrote letters. We did mail drops and stuff so they could give him pictures and stuff. So we made it through.
My name is Gabriela Caprini, and I live in New London. His name is Casey Caprini, and this is his first deployment.
So you're getting very emotional. You're just you're minutes away from seeing him.
Yeah.
He was 15 years old whenever Flight 93 went down, and in school whenever that happened. So that's probably when a patriot was born, and I was happy to hear it's called Patriot's Day now instead of 9/11. Actually, my husband's retired from the Army for 20 years, and so we were in when they first said you had to start family support groups. And so I think that they've been there for everything that was needed anytime. I called one time. She's from El Salvador. She was here on a student visa when they got married, and she wasn't sure about some things, and I was able to call them, and they was able to help me out.
The FRG group have been a great support because they have done everything for us, like providing information and activities to get us to go through, and also friends and family.
So you got married, and then he was deployed 6 months later?
Yeah. Yeah. No children. Yeah. Not yet.
My name is Melissa Bush, and I live in Baltic, Connecticut.
So your husband's been deployed for the last 6 months?
Correct.
And he'll be meeting a new member of the family?
Yes, he'll be meeting his son, Simon, who's 4.5 months old.
And you have another child?
I do. My son, Owen, he's 2.5. So,
what was that like to have him away while your baby was born?
You know, it's sad, but I'm very proud of my husband, and, you know, he's doing a great thing, so I'm very proud. Sad, but proud.
How did the family readiness group help you?
Oh, they're amazing. You know, you miss your husband, but you don't really feel like you're alone. They're always there for you, helping you. Oh, they're coming.
Those were the voices of some of the military families waiting to greet their loved ones who served on the submarine, the USS Annapolis. The crew of 14 officers and 138 sailors made it home safely last Thursday. Coming up, we'll hear about a young military couple's plans for a traditional wedding that had to change abruptly to prepare for a sudden deployment. This is Where We Live. Where We Live, I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil in for John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, Colin McEnroe will guest host the weekly news roundtable, The Wheelhouse. He'll be joined by a panel of reporters and political experts to round up the news of the week. Hope you can join us. Today, we've been talking about the lives of military spouses and families. In 2012, there were more than 1.3 million active duty members of the military, and more than 56% of them were married. Back in 2005, Kristen Owens met her husband, Major Greg Sukup of the U.S. Air Force. They were both in the 30s, living in the D.C. area and looking for love. Well, first comes love, then comes marriage, and Kristen and Greg walked down the aisle January 26th. But the aisle wasn't quite what they expected, nor, in fact, was the date. The casino chips they gave out as party favors said, Kristen and Greg, February 24th, 2007.
See, when it comes to war and peace, everything doesn't always go as planned, as Kristen and Greg soon found out in this piece that originally aired on the Alaska Public Radio Network and was produced by Rebecca Shear.
It was December of 06.
We have to back up a little bit to December of 05.
I was in
D.C., and I had gotten my orders to come up to Elmendorf. My first assignment was to Eielson up near Fairbanks, so I was very happy about coming back to Alaska. I call Alaska home. We had been dating for several months, and that's when we kind of knew that we kind of turned a corner, and we knew that there was something more to the relationship, and we started talking more about coming up to Alaska together.
What we would need to do.
I think you gave me an ultimatum.
I don't remember it quite like that.
I wanted you to come up to Alaska with me, but you said you needed a ring.
I said I didn't have to be married, but I'd have to be engaged.
Okay.
I had left a pretty nice position at the University of Maryland. Sold a house, sold a convertible, gave up some things, and happily so. And when we got engaged in June...
June 22nd.
Yeah. We had already kind of decided that I was coming up. And by August, we were in the car and driving cross-country for 2 weeks, which was fantastic.
So when was the actual date set for the wedding?
We were looking at August of 07. We decided to have a destination wedding in Las Vegas. Nice Vegas.
Nice Vegas.
And
as opposed to...
Bad Vegas. If there is a difference.
Can you paint a further picture of the nice Vegas? What were some nice Vegas elements of this?
There was going to be
wedding?
A gown. No Elvis. It was going to be at the Luxor Hotel.
Mm-hmm. Catered dinner.
Catered everything.
Dancing.
Mm-hmm.
Everything.
Yep, photographer.
And then actually we started talking about maybe we should move it up. I was expecting to be deployed in the summertime, summer of 07. So we said, well, why don't we move it up to February? And that way
just to be safe.
And that way we can get the wedding in Vegas, and then we're going to go on a honeymoon in Athens, Greece.
Mm-hmm. We had over 50 people coming from all over the country to Vegas on February 24th. And plans change. I'm finding that out the longer we're here. You have to be flexible.
Can you take us back to that moment when everything changed?
Well, it was January 22nd, and it was kind of a busy day, and about noon, I found out that I would be deploying much earlier than expected to Baghdad. And they wanted me there in 10 days.
10 days.
10 mm-hmm. days. So I left work and went home and told Kristen the news.
Can you tell me what your reaction was?
I was in the kitchen, and I heard the garage door open, and I first thought somebody was breaking into the house. Or some very smart bear had figured out the electronic code to the garage door. And went outside in my bathrobe, and Greg was getting out of the car, and I said, Greg, what's the matter? And he didn't say anything.
Yeah, I never
and
come
I thought,
home
oh, he
early.
Got, he never comes home early, and I thought, oh, God, he got fired. And then I realized, I don't think you can get fired from the military. It's got to be pretty bad. And then as he was telling me, I had already figured it out, that he was leaving. I knew when I signed on for this job as a military spouse that eventually that would happen, and I knew I'd have to give him up for some time. I didn't realize it would be in 10 days. We were 32 days away from the wedding. That really broke my heart. I think I went through all 7 stages of grief Monday night. And Greg was like, okay, now you're on anger, and now you're on denial, and now you're on... So I went through all of them very efficiently. The first was more selfish. I'm not going to be able to wear my dress. I'm not going to be able to have my father walk me down the aisle. All the little details about a wedding that you think aren't really that important, but after working on it for 3 months and not having a job but planning the wedding, it becomes very important. And so Tuesday morning, I realized that it's not about the wedding. It's not about the dress. It's not about those little things. It's about us and what we need to do.
The basic elements of what getting married is about.
Yeah.
So.
And it means compromise, and it means being flexible, and we did it. Tuesday morning, we went to the vital statistics office downtown. We applied for a marriage license, and we realized that in Alaska, you can actually commission somebody to marry you.
Mm-hmm. So I called my commander, Lieutenant Colonel Tina Morris, and asked her if she would marry us in my unit. She agreed, and we were so busy. I was so busy getting ready to leave and all the paperwork involved and all the picking up supply items that we didn't really do much else other than we went and got a cake, a sheet cake,
a
simple
sheet
cake
from the BX.
And a bouquet.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
and
all
that was
we,
it.
That's all we did. But the troops in the squadron pulled together. It was
that
fabulous
Friday.
What they put together. They converted the conference room to a little kind of a ceremonial chapel with flowers and rose petals, and they put some lights up, and they just really outdid themselves.
They were dressed in their blue uniforms, their blues.
Their dress blues, yeah.
It was thrown together in literally 3 days. The evening before, we had called the Captain Cook Hotel downtown and said, do you have a room available? We told them the story. They said, absolutely, we've got something really nice for you. By the time we get down there, we find out that Greg's unit, the 611, had picked up the tab. His mother had left a gift certificate for dinner. My grandparents had sent flowers.
So you had a honeymoon.
We had a honeymoon. It was called a mini moon. friends and family, they want a party in 6 months when Greg gets back. We promised we would have a big party and a reception. And I will wear the gown. Mm-hmm. We're not sure where it's going to be or when it's going to be. We're going to wait for Greg to get back before we start printing anything up again.
What has life been like since the wedding?
Part of me is almost relieved that the big Vegas wedding isn't happening.
Why is that?
Because it's done. It's done, and I don't have to worry about the little things that don't matter that I know about now that don't matter. Like, is the DJ going to play the right song when we come in? Who cares? You know, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Is my father going to wear a nice-looking tie? Doesn't matter. It's unneeded stress that is now gone. And I'm married, and if anything happens, I'll be the first one they call. So it all worked out in the end. We've waited this long to find each other, and I'm just so glad that
it turned out right.
Yeah.
Somehow it was, everything about it was right.
Yeah, exactly.
That's Kristen Owens and Major Greg Sukup of the U.S. Air Force. This piece originally aired on the Alaska Public Radio Network in 2007 and was produced by Rebecca Shear. Where We Live is produced by Tucker Ives and Lydia Brown. The executive producer is Katie Tilarsky. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel. Thanks for joining us.